Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Between the time I started working on this book and the time I concluded it in summer 2018, dramatic changes took place across the Arab world, particularly in Egypt and Syria. The peaceful protests against tyranny, corruption, and injustice were brutally crushed. The initial and revitalizing moments of hope and pride were dissipated beneath the unrelenting pressure of increased tyranny and violence. The numerous critical voices were systematically marginalized and silenced. Ordinary Egyptians and Syrians were left exposed to the unbridled forces of repression amid the general indifference and at times even complicity of foreign governments. This led me to question the use and meaning of resistance acts in the face of such cruelty and lack of support. It also made me wonder whether documenting those intellectual debates could be, in any practical sense, meaningful or helpful when buffeted by so much criminality and impunity. Nevertheless, I remain convinced that efforts at analytical lucidity, as manifested in the Tanwir debates, and the moral courage that they required under the most forbidding circumstances, are vivid testimonies of life-affirming human intelligence and dignity. They need to be honored, acknowledged, and made available. They are, in my opinion, valuable sources of inspiration for the future struggles for decency and dignity that are bound to emerge again sooner or later. Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Joshua Donovan, and the words you just heard were written by our guest today, Elizabeth Suzanne Kassab. Dr. Kassab is an associate professor of philosophy at the Doha Institute for Graduate Studies in Qatar, where she also heads the philosophy program. Previously, Professor Kassab taught at the American University of Beirut and the University of Belamand in northern Lebanon. She has also been a visiting fellow at several universities and institutions, including Columbia University, the New School, Brown University, the German Orient Institute of Beirut, and many more. In addition to her teaching, Dr. Kassab has written extensively about Arab intellectual history, including her previous book, Contemporary Arab Thought, Culture, Critique, and Comparative Perspective. But today we will be talking about her latest book, Enlightenment on the Eve of Revolution, The Egyptian and Syrian Debates, which was published this year, 2019, by Columbia University Press. Thank you so much for being with us on the show today, Dr. Kassab.
Thank you, Josh, for having me.
So we often start by asking authors to introduce themselves and talk about how they came to work on the book that we're talking about on the show. But I wanted to be a little bit more specific with you, if I could, because your previous book, Contemporary Arab Thought, offered an in-depth account of Arab intellectual history from the Nahda through the disillusionment of 1967, to roughly the end of the 20th century. And I couldn't help but notice it was published in 2009, right before the Arab Spring. So I want to ask, did the Arab Spring uprisings make you rethink your previous work at all? How are you building on that?
Not really. I've always been interested in ideas and how people reflect on the circumstances they're living in and the experiences they're going through. I think that the debates I covered in the previous book are exactly that, document the debates that were taking place during those years, mainly between 67 and the turn of the century. So I don't think that the new debates put my previous reading of the earlier debates in question, really. But as I suggest in my book, I think they exacerbate questions that were really already there before the revolutions. And I think it's important to see the continuity in the sense that people have been reflecting on the deteriorating situation of their societies. And I think that it is also important to note the discontinuities, i.e., when things suddenly take a dramatic turn that was unforeseen by many. And I think that is the consensus among thinkers following up the events in the Middle East, in the Arab world. I think many had a sense that something was building up, but no one really was able to foresee what actually took place, namely those massive protests in the Arab streets.
So the debates that you're talking about that were going on before the uprisings begin focused around a term that you talk about called tanwir. Could you explain to our listeners what this term means and what is the significance of this term? Why tanwir instead of you know, other Arabic words, you know, taqaddum for progress or nahta or something else?
Yeah. Tanwir stands for enlightenment. And I was curious. I mean, I noticed that there were animated debates on tanwir, both in Cairo and in Damascus, in the two decades, during the two decades that preceded the revolts. So I was curious to find out what exactly people meant when they used those terms in the debates. So I did not start, if you want, I did not start with a certain understanding of tanwir and then see how it was applied or not applied. No, I think the exercise I made in writing this book was that of listening. I wanted to pay attention, to listen to those debates and find out what people meant, what they had in mind, what sorts of issues they were preoccupied with, and in that sense, come to an understanding of what this term meant to those using them, using it. In, as I said, in Cairo and then in Damascus. And I don't think that the two debates were related in any sense.
When I hear enlightenment, that term, I automatically think of Western enlightenment, right? I think of Kant and other figures. And you talk about this a bit in your book as well, drawing some comparisons. So how did the Tanwiris deal with the West or notions of Western enlightenment, accusations that to even talk about tanwir is to just sort of import foreign ideas and impose them on the Middle East?
Clearly, people who were using the term tanwir, enlightenment, had a sense of the Western Enlightenment. In other words, they referred, what their understanding referred to the standard Western Enlightenment. And by that, I mean, and they meant an intellectual movement which was connected to a certain political movement towards rationalization, freedom, the use of public reason. And I think that they more or less meant that. But as I say in my book, the debates that took place in Cairo and in Damascus we're in no sense an academic elaboration on that. In other words, these debates were not studies or discussions of Western Enlightenment. They were very much concerned with what was happening in Damascus and in Cairo. So beyond that general understanding of enlightenment as a movement of rationality and freedom, they referred to more concrete realities of Egypt and Syria of the time.
I found your discussion of the importance of context rather than just abstract ideas really, really fascinating and important. And when I think about intellectual history myself, the debate that exists among historians of whether ideas are important as abstract concepts or whether they should be contextualized, I also tend to be a bit more of a contextualist myself. One of the things that they also talk about when thinking about contextualization is the Nahda, right? And that period in the 19th and early 20th centuries of Arab literary renaissance, right? For lack of a better term. A lot of the Tanwiris I noticed were talking about the importance of considering Nahda ideas in their context, right? But clearly the legacy of the Nahda looms largely in both Egypt and Syria. Could you talk a bit about how some of these Tanwiri figures grapple with the legacy of the Nahda?
Yes, this is one of the interesting aspects of these debates, in my opinion. Many of them, as I said, refer to their concrete lived experiences of the times, which is primarily related to political repression, the destruction of the human being, dignity, trust, social relations. So these people are clearly involved in a political discourse, and this is why I characterize these debates as referring to some form of a call to a political humanism. And what is interesting is that in this political reaction, if you want, to the political realities, people pay attention, see the importance of intellectual history. In other words, people were saying, look, we have an intellectual history of ideas to which we can return and connect to in order to anchor our struggle in an intellectual manner. In other words, that in our past, with the Egyptian or Assyrian, say, there were ideas. There was a time when ideas about progress, about rationality, about the possibility of a just rule of democracy were circulating and were sort of shaping our public life. Dictatorships came and disconnected us from this legacy. So it's actually part of the movement, part of the Syrian and Egyptian enlightenment of the 1990s and 2000 is a call to reconnect with this earlier intellectual legacy. And this I find quite fascinating, how intellectual history and a certain rewriting or a reclaiming of intellectual history can become a tool of political protest, of actually human protest. In other words, to say, we want back our dignity, we realized we're being oppressed, we're being dehumanized, and part of our resistance to this is to recall another intellectual legacy we had and to draw on that legacy to strengthen our intellectual awareness and also our values, the values with which we want to resist this unjust dictatorship.
So in a sense, the Tanweer debates seem to be not quite a continuation of the Nahda, but a sort of a reemergence or a revitalization of the Nahda in a different, although not entirely unrelated context.
I think the circumstances are very different, and the problems, the struggle is different. In other words, during the Nahda, you were trying to envision a certain future for new political entities after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. You were thinking, how am I going to shape my Egypt or the Arab world? How am I going to reshape my economy, my culture, my language? So I think it was a time of hope, a time of mobilization towards shaping new political entities. A century later, well, you got those entities and they turned out to be monsters. Powers that took the reign of these countries, of these states, turned them into horrible dictatorships. So actually, already I think soon after the post-Ottoman states were established, and the both post-Ottoman and post-colonialism or mandate rule from the British and the French, say in the 40s, in the 50s, when most of the Arab states were established, there was, of course, a sense of nation-state building. And soon, those hopes of nation-building were collapsed, and people were deeply disillusioned. The 1967 defeat came to aggravate that sense of defeat and disillusionment. So by the time you reach the end of the century, it's really the failure of the post-colonial or the post-independence state that is the big issue. That these states that people wanted to establish as they were constructing their Nahda ideas failed. And so I think already in the post-67 debate, the big issue is that of the state and the failure of the state. And I think the revolts then come as the ultimate, well, not perhaps ultimate since we are where we are today, but really an extreme form of contesting these states.
So since you've begun alluding to it, one of the things that I noticed in your book, and of course, this is true even beyond intellectual history, is how omnipresent both the Egyptian and the Syrian states were. But as you explained in your book, the ways in which both of the states, perhaps predictably, try to suppress or limit the ability for people calling for Tanweer to be successful in actually implementing meaningful political reforms is very different, right? So I want to, just following the order of your book, I want to start with the case of Egypt. The context of these debates in Egypt seem to mirror a wider divide in Egyptian politics between Islam or Islamism, political Islam, however you want to call it, and the state, right? And this has been going on, right, since Nasser and Said Qutb, and I mean, for quite some time. But it was particularly noticeable in the last democratic election of Egypt, right, between Sisi on the, or I'm sorry, between an old member of the regime and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood on the other hand. So how do advocates of Tanwir fit in with the Egyptian state and with Islamist groups like the Muslim Brothers? How do they navigate this binary?
Yes, by the 1990s in Egypt, the polarization was between the state and the political Islam, or the violent political Islam, because assassinations had started to take place, explosions. So the certain Islamic currents had become violent, were challenging the state. And the state was then trying to repress this violence in the name of enlightenment values. And by that, they meant tolerance and rationality and openness and liberties and what have you. Now, so for a long while, say in the whole 1990s, you have the state leading a campaign of enlightenment, and partly by reviving, republishing, re-editing works from the Nahda that call for tolerance, that call for rationality. But of course, this state that was leading an enlightenment campaign was itself a state that had no respect whatsoever to tolerance or to liberties or to rights or to human rights. So in the following decade, in the years of 2000, you find a number of critical Egyptian thinkers who denounce this discourse of the state, of the enlightenment discourse of the state, that of course had no credibility whatsoever. It believed this, most of these critical thinkers thought that the only true enlightenment was really to denounce this, the mendacity of this state that did not respect its citizens, was actually a state sheer force. Needless to say that they were also critical of the Islamic violent currents. So the Enlightenment discourse then in Egypt comes in these two groups, if you want. On the one hand, a state campaign, and on the other hand, deconstruction of this state discourse by critical thinkers. And what this deconstruction brings about is the whole relationship between the Egyptian intellectuals and the Egyptian state. I think this is a major issue of how can Egyptian intellectuals, who are most of them employees of the state, be critical of the state? In other words, how is it possible to practice critical thinking without distance, without concrete distance, financial and employment from the state? This, I think, is a big issue in the Egyptian debate, and it has something to do with the history of the modern Egyptian state, starting with the early or 19th century and the foundation of the Muhammad Ali state. Mm-hmm. So it is this organic link, this bondage between the intelligentsia and the state that is at stake in the Egyptian discussion of Tanwir. Whereas in Syria, the Syrian state did not care to give itself any kind of such mission of enlightenment mission. And in the early 80s, the Islamist movement, including the violent one, was suppressed by the infamous massacres of Hama and the whole the huge incarceration campaign that took place. So there was no Islamist voice inside the Syrian society, you had an omnipotent Syrian state held by a clan, and it terrorized society. And it is in this, under this, in this atmosphere of severe repression, that Syrian thinkers then start to address this state terrorism, that they start to just talk about enlightenment. And for them, Tanwir, or enlightenment, is in the first place a critique of state terror or terrorism, basically.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So basically in Egypt, you have a problem among a lot of Tanwiris of the state trying to co-opt them, co-opt their discourses. And the question, at least to me, seems to be, how do you formulate an alternative, right? Between how can you speak without being co-opted by the state? In Syria, on the other hand, there's really not a whole lot of co-optation, and the question becomes, how do you express reformist ideas at all, right, without being arrested or disappeared by the regime?
Yes, in Egypt, I look at a few concrete examples, figures of the Egyptian intelligentsia, people who were trying to say, okay, we're not co-opted by the state, but we want to reform things from within the system. And of course, it is not possible, and they fall in all kinds of contradictions, and they are severely criticized for it. But there is this phenomenon, this attempt to say, okay, we are, say, university professors, or we are involved in the cultural institutions of the state, and we're going to sort of reform the state and combat the Islamist extremism, which is, of course, an understandable situation for the Egyptian intellectuals, who were neither Islamists, servants of a dictatorship. And these attempts obviously fail. And I give some concrete examples of that. It is only really people outside the system that dared to challenge both and to say that neither this nor that can work. And I think that what is also striking in the Egyptian case is that these intellectuals who were trying to serve the Enlightenment campaign, and sometimes sincere, most of the time, I think quite sincerely, believing in those values and being against fanaticism and violence, were at the same time quite, non-trusting toward the population. These people are not really democrats in the sense that they do not relate to the majority of people, thinking that, well, you know, the majority of the population might not be really inclined to adopt and practice Enlightenment values, and hence the elitism of these intellectuals. In other words, they don't trust people. And this was one of the important criticisms of their discourse. On the other hand, I think they were also, some of them were aware of the difficulty to really be an Enlightenment figure. In other words, to really put forth the ideas of democracy, ideas of human rights, civil rights, liberties, and avoid both elitism and populism. Abu Zayd, Nasser Hamid Abu Zayd, for instance, articulated that quite well, and said that it, not only for Egypt, but in general in the Third World, given the poverty, the collapse of education in these failed states, how do you relate or engage people in your Enlightenment discourse, respect them and respect their impulses or their aspirations to freedom and rationality, and not be elitist, not be populist? How do you manage that? The man was quite aware of the difficulty of the task. So it's so easy, in other words, to be, you know, to be condescending toward the people, say, anyway, you know, we will decide for them because, I mean, they can't play a role. We intellectuals know understand these values, and hence we will be leading the nation, etc. Well, it turns out, and he said, the critical thinkers already in the years 2000 are very clear that unless you engage people, unless you respect them and you address them and you involve them, you're not going to really lead any credible Enlightenment campaign. In Syria, as you said, the state was not at all interested in... Well, it could not really co-opt any intellectual in any serious sense of the term, because the repression was quite total. So you couldn't have a thinking person expressing with any margin of freedom ideas or criticism, and have him or her serve the state. So you have a total alienation of the intellectuals who had to write and think in the very small pockets of freedom at great risk, and do it really in small spaces of expression, like certain periodicals or publications that were circulated in a hush-hush way, and hence the importance of the importance to acknowledge the lucidity and the courage of these people, of these thinkers, who were able to formulate, articulate in clear terms what the problem of that, or if you want, the problematic implications of that dictatorship on the social tissue, on human relations, on the human being itself, and the need then to reconstruct. This is why I call the generation of the 90s really the Sisyphus generation. Some of them called themselves like that, in the sense that it was, they realized, they were very clear about what they could achieve, namely not much except cry in the wilderness and be witnesses of what was taking place. Knowing that they cannot change much, they cannot move anything, but at least do that work of witnessing. Then with the following decade, I speak about the Damascus Spring and the little pockets of public action that were opened for a few months, and how people tried to become active and to act on those ideas. Well, as we know, it didn't last long. Repression hit again until the whole situation exploded in the 2011 revolts.
So there are so many threads that I want to pull on here. And for our listeners, hopefully they can get a sense of how rich your book is just by this conversation and how many different themes that it intersects with. One of the things I want to go back to is this question of Tanwir and secularism versus Tanwir and religion. In the Egyptian case, of course, Islam is quite popular in Egypt for a variety of reasons, right? Some of the Tanwiris have said, you know, that the masses have turned to religion in order to cope with the harsh realities of the regime. Other scholars have noted that Islamist organizations like the Muslim Brothers are just very good at building networks, right, and providing a variety of social services, particularly for poorer people, but also educational institutions, that sort of thing. And then in Syria, of course, emerges differently. But one of the major oppositions to the Assad regime, both past and present, was this sort of was an Islamist group. It was the Muslim Brothers, right, in the early 1980s, and of course today it's Daesh and other radical terrorist organizations. So I'm wondering. Does Tanwir have to be inherently secular, right? Or is there a way in which this notion of enlightenment can coexist with an Islam that would, you know, reverberate or resonate with the people?
Actually, I think that most of critical thinkers using the term Tanwir were rather concerned with dictatorship. I think the big issue, the big enemy, if you want, the big danger was for them the state and the absence of the rule of law and the absence of human rights and civil rights in the first place. And people realized that the only way out is really to carve out as much as possible spaces of political participation. This is the big concern of the Tanwir debates. I don't think that religion, I did not see religion being the topic. I think for most of them, religious extremism was a symptom or I don't want to call it secondary, but part of the manifestations of the absence of political life. I think in my reading of the two sets of debates, I think what people were concerned with, what they meant by Tanwir, was political participation. And what they deplored really was the absence of political life, both in Egypt and in Syria. With in different shapes and forms, the actual call for Tanwir, the enlightenment, is the call for political life, which was confiscated and made impossible by repressive regimes. I think this is the big topic of enlightenment. Religion is not the concern. I mean, I did not find in the Syrian debates under the heading of Tanwir or in the Egyptian debates, a real concern whether people should be Muslim or not, should be pious or not, should be believers or not. That is not what people are worried about. So I think that this is the main topic behind under the headline of Tanwir, political participation.
So if the major problem in Egypt then is a question of how to criticize the regime. I would also criticize more extreme forms of Islamism or theocracy. To navigate this sort of alternative, it seems that you've argued that the political realities in Syria would also need to change pretty dramatically. And you talk about a couple of moments where it seemed like this might possibly happen, right? So chronologically, you start with a conference in, I believe it was 1979, where the state under Hafez al-Assad invited unions and intellectuals to comment on pressing issues, right? There were economic concerns. There were possibly the concern of a rise of political Islam. But then, of course, it was crushed. And then you have the Damascus Spring in 2000 to 2001 with the death of Hafez and the ascension of his son Bashar, where once again intellectuals felt emboldened to make some pretty explicit critiques against the current political situation, and yet again another crackdown. People are talking today about what a new Syria might look like, right, as the civil war begins to possibly start winding down. What do you think the chances are of an opportunity for these intellectuals to once again start pushing serious critiques against the regime in this current moment? Are we going through another Promethean moment, as you talk about, or are we sort of just repeating this Sisyphean pattern of pushing a boulder up down a mountain only to have it come back down at the end of the day?
Wow, I'm afraid we're sub-Sisyphean in the present moment. What I wanted to say before I come back to your question, I was speaking about political participation. Now, I want to say and emphasize the concreteness of the issues here. When I say people, were demanding political participation, it's not because, they read Rousseau, they read Montesquieu, and they said, we like these ideas and we'd rather have these ideas, these things in our societies. These debates come out of people experiencing the consequences of the absence of political life, of political participation. When you don't participate as a political body, as people coming together to control public affairs, to have a check on public affairs and on the use of power and then the abuse of power, then what you have is really the massive robbery of the state, of the country. You have abuse of human rights. You have incarceration. You have torture. You have the collapse of the education system. You have the absence of health services. We're talking, the people whom I read, they were had these catastrophes in mind when they were talking about Tanwir. And I think this is very important to emphasize. It's not although I'm an academic, I'm going to say this was not an academic exercise, like writing comments on Montesquieu or on Rousseau. So the real consequences of the absence of political participation are disastrous. General disaster. People tried several times before 2010 and 2011 to protest, to try and come into the public space, and every time they were repressed. And I think in the literature on these revolts, there were sort of reminders of the waves and waves of attempts at coming back, of people coming back to the public space, whether it's in Egypt or in Syria. And so when people say we want political participation is control of people who are in power and to put rules and regulations to part. This is why the first time there was a tiny opportunity in Syria of people coming together and forums were constituted, people came together to discuss public economy, finances, corruption. Corruption is the big, one of the big topics. Corruption, police abuse, police brutality. This is what happens when you have no control over those who have power. So where are we now? Will there be another Sisyphus, another Prometheus? I think we are now witnessing even, like everybody's saying, an even bigger a catastrophe, a bigger devastation. And if I want to use one word that is quite recurring, especially in the Syrian debate, that of kharab. Kharab in Arabic being ruin, disaster, collapse. That's the recurring term. These people were witnessing kharab in a very, as I said, collapse of education, of health, of this, of that. And so the call for Tanweer is really attempts at coming out of that kharab. Unfortunately, what we witnessed both in Egypt and in Syria, particularly in Syria, is even a bigger kharab. The forces, the powers that were stayed and became even more ferocious. And here we are in bigger kharab.
Just to throw it out there, this wasn't talked about explicitly in your book, but I'm just curious if in the current moment, given the massive displacement of people in Syria, whether there have been voices from diaspora, right? And I couldn't help but think of this as a historian, and I try to bring in diasporic voices in my own work. Where, you know, going back to the Ottomans, sometimes just being out of the political situation allowed intellectuals and activists to be able to speak a bit more freely. Is there any attempt to construct a civil space? I mean, obviously not political participation in Syria, but just a civil discourse of the current situation outside of the geographic confines of Syria?
Oh, yes. I think in the diaspora, both the Syrian and the Egyptian, especially the Syrian, there is work that is being produced. There are attempts at thinking through what people are experiencing, which I think is an unbelievable effort, and one wonders how people can still think at all in the midst of so much pain and destruction. But there is work being produced, and I think I try to follow it and archive it as much as possible. But there is archiving going on, and I know people are working, dissertations are being written on cultural, intellectual production of the diaspora. I think that will be an important component of any future reconstruction of Syrian intellectual and cultural production.
So just stepping back a bit, I want to deal with two final pretty interrelated issues that stood out to me. And we've alluded to this a bit before, but I want to talk first about the relationship between intellectuals and the masses, quote unquote. And the second related issue is this notion of reception, right, that often arises in intellectual histories of all sorts. So in the book, you're a bit circumspect or humble as a scholar on the links between the Tanweer debates and the Arab Spring uprisings. But I want to just push you a little bit on this. A lot of the sources that you use here were books or conferences, in some cases edited volumes of conferences, where these Tanweer ideas were being discussed. But some of the discourses were also published in very popular and widely read newspapers, like Beirut's An-Nahar, for example. So to the extent that you know, how popular are these thinkers? And is it possible that they might have had some influence in setting a discursive stage for protesters, or at least protesters who were among the educated or middle classes?
Yeah, this is a good question that I would like to have answered too. But thank you for giving me the opportunity to underline this point that was very important for me. I worked on ideas, and I work on ideas because I'm interested in ideas. It's not because ideas are more important than other things. And now the question about the influence or the impact of these ideas on political movements. I have no idea, and this is not at all my argument. So I wanted to make sure in the book that I'm not saying that because these debates took place that we had the revolts of 2011. I just wanted to make the observation that what people in the Tanweer debates were evoking, were talking about, were pointing at were more or less the same things that people expressed in the Arab streets during the revolts. In other words, the same concern about the demand for dignity, the demand for political participation, the protest against the rejection of violence, of police brutality. So I saw, if you want an echo, I saw a similarity. And I think it makes sense, if I want to take it perhaps on a simplistic common sense level, saying that these intellectuals were people like their fellow people around them, and they were experiencing the same circumstances. So it is a bit natural, perhaps, that they were concerned with the same concerns. Now, you could have had a case where intellectuals were totally on a different plane and were disconnected. Yeah, but in this case, what I noticed was that they did share quite similar concerns. Now, what I want to what I want to make sure is that I am not making any causal connection. And in that sense, I had no answer to the impact question. Then what value or what importance do these ideas have if we cannot really give them an impact role? I don't know. I think I find it important that people were able to articulate conceptually what they and their fellows were going through, and that somehow the moral compass was quite clear for them, as it was clear for the masses. Now, the link between intellectuals and masses, this I will leave to fellow sociologists or historians. I could not, I wouldn't be able to answer that question.
Sure. Well, I do appreciate your book bringing in the history of ideas, because I mean a lot of ink has been spilled about the Arab Spring uprisings and especially causal factors, right? Issues of political repression, rampant unemployment, neoliberalism, all sorts of things that are talked about and you mention a bit in your book, but it is nice to see a bit of the intellectual and cultural context, even if explicit links aren't there, or, if we're not sure if they're there, it requires further study. I think the history of ideas is very important when you're talking about any sort of massive political change. Just sort of my opinion as a historian. Mm-hmm. So the last question, if we could keep you for just another minute or two, is what are you working on next? What's your next project, if you can?
Well, I'm very much interested in, as I said, in working on the debates that followed the revolts. and particularly the 2013 turning point. I think it was the August 2013 was a turning point both in Egypt and in Syria. In Egypt, as you know, the Rabia massacre, Sisi coming to power and massacring hundreds of Islamist militants and citizens, the huge wave of arrests and the huge repression that followed. I think that moment when Sisi comes to power, what did intellectuals or some intellectuals say? How did they accompany? What were the comments? What were the words of caution or the absence thereof with which they accompanied these events? So I think that the 2013 is a very dramatic moment, moral and political turning point in the Egyptian revolution. And I have amassed a number of writings around that period. Similarly, in Syria, August 2013 is the chemical attack on the Damascus suburbs and this evaporation of any red line. And that also is a dramatic turning point for the Syrian revolution, where people felt totally abandoned by the world, by the world community, by governments, and the Assad regime having total liberty to massacre its population. And then what it does to people who believed and gave their best for democracy, for human rights, for civil liberties. What did that do to the revolutionaries in that sense? Again, there I follow Syrian intellectuals. And so I would like, but I'm a slow writer, I'm a slow worker, so it will take a number of years before hopefully I can document, because they are worth documenting, I think, and produce something on the Egyptian and Syrian 2013 period.
I know it's a conversation that historians are just beginning to have, but there is this really important question that I think everyone who works in some capacity on the Middle East has to grapple with. Well, and even beyond the Middle East, but being in the age of the internet, right, there is this question of how to create an archive, as you've said, or how to document things that are not just in published works or newspapers that, you know, a lot of scholars are comfortable consulting, but how do you, you know, preserve or document Twitter posts or YouTube videos and things like that? So I for one, look forward to watching you and other scholars do that and seeing your next work whenever it does emerge.
Yes, there is indeed an abundance of material, which is somehow sometimes despairing because you don't know anymore where to draw the line. But abundance, I think, is good. And people should take little bits and pieces and try to work on them and eventually, you know, form a literature on this. And let me throw in one last word here. I work on ideas because that's what I know a little bit how to do. But art is another fascinating field here, both before and after the uprisings. I think artistic history, and there is a lot of work going being done now, is also equally fascinating. And I think the links, the linkages one could make between intellectual production and artistic production would be another interesting field.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today on the show. We really appreciate you speaking with us today.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.